Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call on this Saturday, July 17th, 2010. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you for the next 60 minutes as we look into the world of sports. British Open is going on as we speak. Right now, some of the top guys are about to tee off. Tiger is underway through a couple of holes. Is right now it's four under even through. It's four under. Luis Oosthuizen, who's the leader, has yet to tee off along with Mark Kakavecchia, Paul Casey. Oosthuizen is 12 under. Of course, Kakavecchia is 7 under. Paul Casey is 6 under. Some of those guys are still have not teed off as of yet. They will in probably the next 30 or 40 minutes. And well, first of all, you gotta look at speaking of the leader, you gotta look at this guy who when I saw the leaderboard yesterday, I said, looking like who is this dude? I Googled him. I was surprised they had him on even through Google. You want to talk about obscure leaders. I mean, listen, we've seen obscure leaders go through leader major through the first round, but never. I don't think we've seen a guy this unknown leader major through two rounds. I can't know. It would be a long time. And this is a guy who is right. Who's ranked 54th in the world? So obviously he can play a little bit, but has played in 8 majors, has not made the cut in 7 out of the 8 majors he's played in. The highest that he's ever finished in a major was 73rd at the 2008 PGA Championship. So he is not a guy who has a pedigree of doing anything in majors. He's not one of these guys who has who said, hey, look out for him under the radar. Look out for him. He could be an unsung guy who can make no noise, who can make some noise. But no, not at all. I mean, this guy, nobody knows who he is. So he's come out with back-to-back rounds of 65 and 67. And, again, came out of nowhere. I mean, he had 65 in round one, but really wasn't talked about that much because there all everybody wanted to talk about was Rory McIlroy, who shot 63 in the first round, was not under, and everybody was crowning him as the next, 21 years old. He's supposed to be the next big thing. And next thing you know, Rory McIlroy, a day later, shoots at 80, which is one of the biggest turnarounds in the wrong direction in major championship history. And what has happened with this tournament is it's become a tournament that has become unpredictable based on the weather. I mean, the first day on Thursday, weather was basically perfect. Guys were killing this course. I mean, the scores were outrageous. I believe the average score was something like 69, or something to that nature. I mean, nature. The scores were. You look at how many guys who were under par in the first round. It was just absurd amount of players that were under par. Second round. That's when the wind and this weather took over. You saw the 40-mile-an-hour winds. They stopped play. Play got delayed for about an hour or so. Because the wind was blowing so hard. The wind got up to about as much as 35, 40 miles an hour. The last 25 groups, which included 75 players, not one of those guys broke par. And if you were somebody who had to tee off late in the day, you got burnt. you got burnt without question. I mean, those guys, you know, the weather got worse as the day went on. The weather got worse. Or, excuse me, if you saw it at the tee off a little bit earlier on, later on, you got burnt. First day, day one, it was the guys who were able to get off to an early start that had it, you know, took advantage of that. Again, Thursday was the complete opposite. Guys who teed off late got burnt with the weather and how it was going. Today, the weather has calmed down a bit. Really hasn't been too much of a factor as some of the contenders start to tee off, you know, like start to tee off, like I said, in the next 30 minutes or so. Again, the tournament is wide open. I mean, when you can talk about having a guy having a eight-stroke swing, I mean, anything can happen. I mean, I don't know anything about this Lewis Ostrosusen. I mean, the guy has never been in this position before. I don't know how he can deal with championship pressure, this course, the weather. I mean, who knows? He can go out there and shoot a 75 today or a 76. So to try to predict this tournament is impossible. A couple of guys that are making runs right now, Mickelson and Garcia, are 4 under. They are making runs. You certainly have to keep your eye on them. Calcum Becchia has won this tournament before. You know, Westwood, you know, has won it. Westwood, you know, looking for his first major. You know, of course, always Tiger Woods. We'll see what happens with him. But right now, if you're asking me who's going to win this tournament, I have absolutely no idea. I mean, it seems that there's been no patterns whatsoever. I mean, the play, when the weather's been good, I mean, guys have played well, put up big numbers, but it seems like the weather that you saw on Thursday is never going to return for the duration of this tournament. I mean, this today might be as good as it gets as far as the weather goes. You know, these guys are going to be fighting. A lot of it's going to depend on when you tee off. You know, it simply might just come down to that, when guys are going to get on the golf course and have, you know, that might be just the luck of the draw, so to speak, for determining who wins this tournament. I mean, what will the conditions be like when a particular group of players are playing? Again, right now, you have basically a no-name leading the tournament. And again, this guy, nobody outside the golf world, nobody knows who this guy is. Nobody. I mean, he was. They were making a joke of, you know, how they introduced him as another particular player, because they didn't know who he was. He's from South Africa. You know that he's, you know, supposedly close to Ernie Els. Other than that, you really don't know who he is. And again, he's 12 under. And again, those numbers are going to drop. I think these scores, you know, you're going to see the winner somewhere, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 under. I don't see scores going high. I don't see anybody going above 7, 8, 9, 10. And I don't see anybody going above those scores. I think some of these scores are going to drop. I don't think they're going to plummet. I don't think you'll see, you know, U.S. Open scores. But nobody's going to run away and dominate this tournament. There will be, come tomorrow morning, there will be 7, 8, 9 guys, I think, in contention. I think some of these guys at the top of the board will come back to the pack, and it's going to be a wild finish coming tomorrow. It is absolutely a wide open tournament. Still to come on this first edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, we will look back at the boss, and I'm not talking about Bruce Springsteen, Yankee owner, of course, George Steinbrenner, who passed away this week. looking back at some of his career, and you know, a decision that that baseball made that benefited the Yankees. I'll tell you about that, and we'll also look at why this might be, matter of fact, why this is a must-win major for Tiger Woods. We'll talk about that as well on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Welcome back to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you to 12 o'clock. George Steinbrenner, of course, passed away this week, had died of a massive heart attack, a longtime Yankee owner, and really a guy who really changed the entertainment aspect of baseball. I mean, when you think about when he bought the Yankees, it's amazing when you look through some of this stuff of just how down the Yankees were. I mean, this is the New York Yankees. See, they were owned by CBS. He bought them in 1973, and you know, along with a couple of investors, and yeah, I mean, it's a, like you would never think. I mean, you never would have thought, based on where the Yankees were at right now, that there was a time when, you know, they as an organization were basically losing money, and CBS was, from a financial standpoint, running them into the ground. They were struggling on the field. Steinbrenner comes up, buys them. 4 years later, they win their first of back-to-back championships in 77 and 78, of course, with the great Reggie Jackson and Billy Martin, you know, combining forces, and that whole dynamic, which was documented a couple of years ago, and ESPN did the movie "The Bronx Is Burning" about, you know, those three, Steinbrenner, Jackson, and Billy Martin, their relationship. But something happened, you know, between 1978 and 1996. The Yankees did not win a championship. And, you know, Steinbrenner, again, was, you know, the Yankees were ascending to be the most powerful organization in all of baseball, through financially and through the television deals that they were signing with MSG, with MSG, and, you know, they were making money hand over foot, but they weren't winning anything. And a lot of part of the reason why they weren't winning anything, or a big reason why they weren't winning anything, was because Steinbrenner, you know, unlike the business genius that he was nowhere near that as far as being a baseball man. I mean, Steinbrenner was a guy who didn't have very little patience with managers, didn't have patience with players, and was basically raiding the farm system of the New York Yankees in order to try to get the quick fix. I mean, he was Daniel Snyder. I mean, for Redskins fans that live around this area, you know, he was Daniel Snyder before Daniel Snyder, as far as just, you know, a business genius, and as far as a guy who, you know, was playing fantasy baseball. And until 1990, it didn't come until 1990 when Steinbrenner got suspended for paying a gambler to dig up information about Dave Winfield, got a lifetime ban that ended up being reduced, you know, to 2.5 years, came back in 1993. But during those 2.5 years, Gene Michael, along with some of the other Yankee brass, started developing top-notch talent out of their farm system, and then, Harris, you had the core five. What came about along, and I say the core five and Bernie Williams. So you had Bernie Williams, with, you know, who ended up winning 4 championships with the Yankees. You had Rivera coming. You had Mariano Rivera, Jorge Posada, Derek Jeter, and Andy Pettit kind of, you know, Michaels was able to lay the foundation for the Yankees to win, you know, those five championships from 96, excuse me, those 4 championships in 5 years from 96 to 2001, and then Steinbrenner again went nuts after the late Yankees lost a classic Game 7 series against Arizona Diamondbacks in 2001, and just started spinning ridiculously, and went to basically the same pattern he went to into the '80s, and it wasn't until last year when the Yankees hit the jackpot in free agency with the likes of CeCe Sabathia, Mark Teixeira, that they were able to get back on top, AJ Burnett, that they were able to get back on top and win another championship. But think about it, had Steinbrenner not been suspended back in 1990, would the Yankees have, you know, five championships in, you know, in 14 years? And I don't think so. I mean, I think the Yankees would be, I don't know if they would have won any championships. Maybe they get one. Maybe they would have won last year, but I don't know, because Steinbrenner would have probably traded. You can make a case that they still would be going through that championship drought from 1978, because, you know, Andy Pettit might not have been on the team, Mario Rivera might not have been on the team, but Derek Jeter might not have been on the team. I mean, these were Jorge Posada. These were guys who were sought off prospects who, you know, Jeter's going to the Hall of Fame. Pettit has an outside chance to make it to the Hall of Fame. Rivera is one of the greatest pitchers of all time. He's going to the Hall of Fame. You know, they have two of those guys. If Posada will have an outside chance, considering what he's done offensively as a catcher. So two of those guys are locked Hall of Famers. Bernie Williams is not a Hall of Famer, but he was a very, very good player. If not for the injuries, could have been a Hall of Famer, but he just had too many injuries. But he had the kind of talent that could have gotten to that, could have been a Hall of Famer, but just never exploded for that 40 home run, 120 RBI season. He always hit well. You know, always was somewhere between 315, 320 in that range. Some of the years he even hit higher than that. You know, was a 20 to 25 home run guy, 100 RBI. You know, he never was that big number guy. That 40 home, like I said, 35 to 40 home run guy. 115, 120, that he never was on that level player, but he was a clutch player in the postseason. And a guy, again, if Steinbrenner is not around, if Steinbrenner was around, he would not have been on the team. I mean, there's a story that Steinbrenner won Bernie Williams traded, and he told Gene Pikles to shot Williams to all, you know, to, you know, 27, the other, at the time, the other 27 teams. And Michael said, okay. So Michael doesn't shop Bernie Williams, he shops a better player to all 27 teams to be traded. They didn't want that particular player. So Michael comes back to Steinbrenner and says, hey, I shopped them to all 27 teams said no. They had no interest. And there you go with that. So, I mean, they had a lot of times people would, there were times certainly when people within the organization had to protect Steinbrenner from himself, with his lack of patience, you know, with players at times, and certainly with managers. With that said, I mean, you have to consider, to me, he has to be considered the greatest owner in the history of sports, considering the success he's had in both, you know, from an entertainment standpoint, and creating the Yankee brand, and all along with the winning. I mean, they've won 7 championships since he's been the owner. They've been, you know, 11 pennants since he's been, you know, 11 pennants since he's been the owner, and they've just had the kind of success that no other franchise in baseball can even come close to since he took over in 1973. Matter of fact, even in sports, the only owner that can have comparable success would be Jerry Buss of the Lakers, who has been a part of now 10 championships in the last 30 years or so. So Steinbrenner, again, is a guy who did it his way. I mean, he did it his way. He's a perfect, he's that perfect guy when you look at stuff like this and when you go back. He's a perfect guy as far as there's no box that you can put him into. I mean, it's either you love him, it's either you love him or you hate him. It's a black and white. There's no black and white with Steinbrenner. I mean, this is a guy who had every employee on their heels, on pins and needles. I mean, he would fire secretaries. Steinbrenner, Steinbrenner was that type of guy. It wasn't just about baseball. He was about the business of baseball. And a lot of people will say part of that genius wasn't good for baseball as far as the economic situation. That if it wasn't for George Steinbrenner, that baseball would have a salary cap. Would the game be better off with a salary cap? Who knows? I mean, who knows? I mean, baseball. I would like to see a salary cap, but the bottom line is there are a lot of teams that benefited from the money, generated by the Yankees as far as revenue. Baseball does have a pretty good revenue sharing plan. And a lot of these owners are just not spending the money. I mean, they have the money to spend. They are just not choosing to spend it. That's one thing about Steinbrenner that you cannot knock. Yes, he made the money, but he also put the money back into his product. I mean, he put the money back into his product. I mean, the Yankees are the most valuable franchise in all of sports. But they just got a new stadium. They have the highest payroll in all of baseball. As a Yankee fan, you have to be, ecstatic of having an organization that's going to do whatever it takes to win. Some of these organizations, Pittsburgh Pirates, Kansas City Royals, Steinbrenner has put money in their pockets. For some reason, they cannot figure a way to do anything with it. Or they're not putting money in the right places in terms of their scouting departments, their upper management. They're just poorly ran. And again, I can't put that on George Steinbrenner because, truthfully, look at the NBA. There's a salary cap in the NBA. There's a hard cap in the NBA, and some of the teams still have a couple, two, three, four, five teams that probably shouldn't even have a cities that shouldn't even have a team that don't want to spend money. Look at New Orleans and the prospects of losing Chris Paul in the next year or so. Look at the Clippers all those years with Donald Sterling. So I don't think you can blame Steinbrenner for owners who just don't want to outright spend the money, either through revenue that they're not generating, or just come out their pockets. And most of these guys are billionaires in their own rights. They just don't want to put the money back. They don't want to put the money back into. They don't want to put the money back into these teams. But again, George Steinbrenner understood how to raise the value of the entertainment dollar. And he's done it in a time where, think about what baseball has been through. He's done it through strikes. He's done it through a bad economy. The Yankee ticket is a prime ticket in sports right now. The only ticket that comes close to it to me is, say, the Los Angeles Lakers. And I never put the. I don't compare football because football is only 16 games. So, I mean, the Buffalo Bills is a prime ticket in football. I mean, football is just is a different animal. I mean, yeah, franchises more successful that struggle from a revenue standpoint. The Pittsburgh Steelers. You wonder why the Steelers don't sign everybody when they get good or when they up for have a chance to make big contracts. They can't afford it. It's not just because they don't want to overpay players, but they can't afford it because they don't have a they don't generate that kind of revenue like the Redskins or like the Cowboys that will allow them to go out to sign all the players once they get good. That's why they have to draft well in order to stay competitive, in order to stay at the level that they're at. But again, I'm not so sure that the Yankees would be the Yankees as far as winning. As far as baseball basically protected him from himself. We may be looking at him a little bit different from a baseball standpoint had he not been suspended back in 1990. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Is this a must-win for Tiger Woods? Is this British Open a must-win for Tiger Woods? We'll talk about that and get into some baseball on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Surreal Quinn, taking you to the top of the 12 o'clock hour. Welcome back to the latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Of course, the British Open is going on as we speak. And that's the only thing about the British Open that, the only one thing about the British Open that you just, that's hard to take is the time difference. I mean, you got to get up basically at the crack of dawn in order to watch the tournament. You know, you're not allowed to on Sunday enjoy, a nice Sunday dinner, come home at 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock and come home at 1 or 2 o'clock and have the tournament waiting for you around 3 o'clock. You got to get up 6 a.m., 6:30, 7 o'clock to watch the final round. And that's the one thing that bothers me about that, always has bothered me about the British Open. But regardless, it's still a great tournament. Still a great tournament. Still one of the top tournaments out there. Still one of the best majors out there to watch. You had to rank them. You probably have to rank. Matter of fact, it probably is ranked behind the Masters as far as being the most prestigious of the four major tournaments, with the PGA being, dead last by a mile. So, again, Tiger Woods right now, the last time I was able to see it is 4 under. Wonder as he chases major number 15, which has become elusive within the last couple of years. Woods has not won a major in going on now 2 years. He's gone through obviously the off the course shindigs with what happened last Thanksgiving and the whole crashing, the fire hydrant, crashing the Escalade and what have you with his wife, and had it coming off a bad knee that really took him out of, that really cost him his 2008 and really a lot of 2009 as well in terms of trying to recover from that. And he right now, you know, Woods is 34 years old. He'll be 35 in December. Doesn't have as much time as you think. When you look at some of the all-time greats, as far as when they won their last majors, Tom Watson was 34. Arnold Palmer was 34. Ben Hogan was 41. Gary Player was 42. Sam Snead was 41. I don't count Bobby Jones because he retired at 28. I mean, he retired from play at 28, so I don't count Bobby Jones from that standpoint. Even though he is all-time great. But the latest one that you see on here is Jack Nicklaus, of course, Nicklaus at 46 when he won the 86 Masters, which is more of an aberration than the norm when it's come to a lot of these guys who have won majors. You know, you figure that he has, say, 5 years left in terms of in his prime, even by golf standards, from, say, 35 to 30. Say he has, you know, putting this out, say he has 21 majors. He has 21 majors in order just to tie Nicklaus's record at 14, excuse me, at 18. I mean, he's basically going to have to win basically almost one major a year, a little less than one major a year, assuming that he doesn't win another major this year. He'll go into next year at 35, five prime years, 20 majors, having to win four to tie and five to break. Based on what we've seen in the last year or so, even this year, would you put your money on that? I mean, would you put your money on that? I mean, Woods, you know, as each major goes by, it's less and less likely that he's going to break that record. I mean, the intimidation factor has completely dissipated as far as the rest of these guys go. They have respect for Woods. They say great things about him. They'll even go as far as saying he should be a favorite. But they are not intimidated by Tiger Woods. Not in the least bit. And again, Woods is not, you know, his days are getting better all over. I mean, he's as far as his skill set. I mean, it's going to be a struggle for him just to get back to where he was before the knee surgery, before his knee problem back in 2008. It's not going to get any better. The field is as deep as it's ever been. Now, the quality depth is not as strong as it was when Nicklaus was playing and he had Watson, Palmer, those guys at the top. Gary Player, it's not that strong. But from 1 to, say, 150, I mean, you know, look who's on the leaderboard. I mean, look who's on the leaderboard as far as the British Open this weekend. Not exactly a who's who of golfers. And to me, Woods, you know, until he, and I said this repeatedly this past, you know, in this past year as he's going through these majors, until he gets, and he's going to have to swallow his pride and play more events in order to get back his game. He can't, you know, he can no longer, you know, do that thing where he plays his schedule around the majors. He doesn't have that luxury anymore from a skill set standpoint. He has to get back. He might have to play two or three or four extra tournaments in order to get his skill set, get his skill level back to where it once was. You know, I'm not going to compare it to Andre Agassi going and playing in the Challengers Tour. You know, when he completely lost interest in the game. But Woods is going to, I mean, he's going to have to humble himself to a standpoint to where it's like, hey, you know, in the past, maybe I didn't choose to play this tournament. Okay, I'll play in this tournament just so I can get some extra work in, some extra rounds in a competitive surroundings. Again, there was a time where I thought that I would never even be having this discussion on whether or not he was going to break this record. It was inevitable that he was going to break this record. And to be honest with you, if you had asked me back in 2007, I would have said that he would already broken this record. I would have thought that he would already broken this record. So again, this, you know, if he can win this tournament, it would be, you know, a boost to his career, obviously get him closer to Jack Nicklaus. But it would be, you know, for just his confidence, it would be huge just for his confidence. Be big for his confidence if he can get back and win this tournament. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. No Yankee players Yankees miss a funeral, and we'll look back at some Saturdays at some Friday night baseball as the second half kicks off. That's still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Welcome back to this last edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Second half has kicked off in baseball, beginning with some key series. Last night, the Yankees were able to defeat the Tampa Bay Devil Rays 5-4. Nick Swisher drives in a walk-off hit, give the Yankees an emotional win, so to speak, on a night where they honored two legends that have been lost in Yankee history as far as George Steinbrenner. And last weekend, Bob Sheppard, the longtime PA announcer, who was with the Yankees for 50 years, a little bit of controversy in regards to Bob Sheppard coming to New York. Apparently, no New York Yankee player attended Sheppard's funeral, which was, I believe, was on Thursday. Yeah, it was Thursday. And then you have reports come out that the Yankees had a player bus that got stuck in traffic due to an accident that in which three people died. It was completely nonsense. That report was nonsense. Yankee brass and everybody, Yankee organization denies anybody ever being in a bus that was headed towards the funeral. That the Yankees really had no Yankee players had no plans of going to the funeral. Derek Jeter, of course, kind of is at the forefront of this because he was a guy, you know, the captain of the team. He, you know, said all these great things about Bob Sheppard, still uses Bob Sheppard, Bob Shepard to do his introduction. He said he'll do it for the rest of his career. That, you know, that's all well and good. But listen, I mean, everybody doesn't like funerals. You know, it's not. I can understand it not wanting to be, but to me, if you're a Yankee player, especially if you're, I mean, forget about A-Rod, forget about Nick Swisher, but if you are a Derek Jeter, you got to be at that funeral. And to me, that's a part of you being the captain. You know, you are the face of the franchise from a player standpoint, without question. Everybody looks to you as a leader, and to me, you have to be at that funeral. If Derek Jeter is at that funeral, no other Yankee player showed up, then this is not even a stump. I'm not even talking about this right now. You know, Jeter goes on to say, well, you know, a couple of things Jeter said. One of them made sense. The other one made zero sense. Number one, he said that you don't have to be at a funeral to honor a player, to honor somebody, you don't have to be at a funeral to honor that person. I can understand that. But then he came out, he says that nobody knew that the funeral was on Thursday. That one, and I'm not buying that one. I mean, how is anybody within the Yankee organization not going to know the time or the date of that funeral, let alone the players? I mean, it makes no sense. That one I don't buy at all. I mean, that, to me, I mean, just come out and say, hey, I mean, you should have just stuck with the first statement about not having to go to a funeral to honor a person. You should have just stuck with that one. You know, the idea that nobody in that Yankee organization, that no Yankee player knew what time, knew the day of the funeral, what day was Bob Shepard's funeral, is absolutely just, I mean, you're kidding me. There's no way. There's no way that those players didn't know when that funeral was. I mean, you're Derek Jeter. You couldn't call somebody and say, hey, you couldn't call, have your publicist call somebody within the organization and say, hey, when is Bob, by the way, when is Bob Shepard's funeral? It makes no sense. So you say you didn't know when the funeral was? Are you kidding me? So that one, you know, that kind of didn't make too much sense to me. Again, I feel like if you're Derek Jeter, you know, leading the team, that you should be at the funeral. You are the leader of the team. You are the face of the franchise. So from that standpoint, it did not look good on Jeter's behalf or on the New York Yankees' behalf as well. The only guys that were at the funeral, from what my understanding was, were Brian Cashman. As I pull out the article right now, with Brian Cashman. Yankee publicist Jason Zillow said, we didn't organize any bus for the players. So it was made that story about the players being on the bus and got stuck in traffic. Nonsense. And here's what Jeter said. To be quite honest with you, I didn't even know his funeral was yesterday. Now, this is a Friday article. His funeral, of course, was on Thursday. Having said that, I don't necessarily think you have to go to a funeral to honor someone. I think a lot of players have honored him. It's the reason why I've recorded his voice throughout the years, and I'll continue to honor him every time I go to the plate for the rest of my career. But I was not aware of it, and I don't know how many other players were aware of it. I mean, come on. This is, woo. I mean, and the only Yankee employee that was at the funeral, this is the only prominent Yankee employee that was at the funeral, was Brian Cashman. So, you had no Hank Stanley, no Hank Steinbrenner, no Hal Steinbrenner, no Randy Levine, just Brian Cashman. No players, no Derek Jeter, no Andy Pettit, no Mariano Rivera. No Jennifer Swindle, Jennifer Steinberg Swindle. Just, I mean, Yankees have to do a better job at that than that. I mean, you have to do. You can't listen. This guy announced your game for 56 years. He's a part of New York. He's a part of the culture of New York sports. I mean, you want to call him, you want to put this title to him, call him, Reggie Jackson, call him the voice of God and what have you. And he'll show up to again. He'll show up to the funeral. But again, the Yankees were able to get a win last night over Tampa Bay. They take a three game lead over Tampa Bay. Boston lost last night to Texas. Boston, of course, needs to get healthy in the worst way. Boston is now six games behind the Yankees. Minnesota got a key with Chicago against the White Sox, snapping their nine-game winning streak. Yeah, St. Louis continues to own the Dodgers. St. Louis continues to own the Dodgers. The Mets cannot score a run against San Francisco. They lose for the second straight. They get shut out for the second straight night. Thursday, they lost, I believe, they lost 2-0. Last night, lose 1-0. Mets are in a tailspin right now. Lost 8 out of their last 9 games. They're in the midst of now a brutal 11-game road trip that could define their season as far as that division goes. Maybe it doesn't. I mean, this could be something that this could be. They cannot afford to have a 3-8, 2-9 type trip. They really, really need to be 6-5 or 5-6 at worst to try to keep up with the Braves and the. Braves, who continue to play well despite losing last night to Milwaukee 9-3. Strasburg, another big game out of him. He wins his fourth game of the year, going six shutout innings against the Florida Marlins, a team that frankly have owned the Washington Nationals over the years. So Strasburg, again, another big game for him. He's pitched great since he's come up. Keep your eye on the trading deadline as it approaches. It is 2 weeks away, July 31st. Alex Gonzalez goes from Toronto to Atlanta this week, which was a good move for Atlanta, getting rid of UL Escobar, who just frankly wasn't producing. And then, I don't think he had a home run this season. So it's a good trade for him. There are a lot of guys that are still available that could be there, especially pitching prospects that can be got as far as trade value, as far as being traded, with guys like Danny Heron, Roy Oswalt, Carmona, Edwin Jackson, Oxolio Dovetail, just name a few that could still be available to be moved. Question is to me, which one of these sluggers are going to be moved? I mean, especially when you look at the Washington Nationals as far as Adam Dunn. Adam Dunn has been tearing the cover off the ball of late. He has about 22 home runs. If you're the Nationals, do you feel like that you can get good enough that you can get to a point to where you are a contender before he gets old? I mean, that's a question you have to ask yourself. Dunn is. I want to say 31 years old. You can give him a 4-year deal. I'm sure he wants a 4-year, somewhere 4 years, 50, 48, 4 years, $60 million deal. Wants Jason Bay type money because he's had Jason Bay type production. It's not even better than Jason Bay type production. So he truly deserves a contract of that nature. But do you give a guy, if he's 34, 35 years old and your team is still in the basement of the National League East, is it worth it? Or if a team can come by and blow you away with some prospects, then do you make the deal? I mean, how good, showing you what will happen with Jason Dunn will show you where the Nationals feel like they are at as an organization, how close they are in terms of contending for a playoffs. If they trade him, that will tell you that they think they're close. If they trade him, that will tell you that they don't think that they're that close and that signing will be a waste. If they sign him, then they must feel like they or within a year or two of really making some noise in the National League East. But again, somebody blows you away with some prospects, then I feel like you have to make the move. But in the past, you know, guys, in the past, teams never seem to receive equal value when it comes to these moves. Whether it's Minnesota trading Johan Santana, you know, what even you know, even with the Phillies getting rid of Cliff Lee, even with the Indians getting rid of Cliff Lee, for that matter, these teams, you know, when you trade these big time players, the teams, I mean, as far as these prospects, the teams almost never receive equal value. Now, again, there are some exceptions. Cleveland, you know, with the whole Cleveland with the deal that they made for the with the pitcher a few years ago, his name is slipping my mind right now, but they ended up getting Cliff Lee and Grady Sizemore for the Bartolo Colon deal. That was the deal. When Cleveland traded away Bartolo Colon to the then Montreal Expos. So they end up getting two players who were all-star caliber players, Taylor Cliffley and Grady Sizemore. Sizemore, who has not been healthy, but when healthy, he is an all-star caliber player. But for the most part, those deals don't go in the favor of the team that's given up the big-time player. Because you have the all-star game this week, and I think that, you know, this home field advantage part of the all-star game should be scrapped. The All-Star Game, you know, had its lowest ratings, had its lowest ratings in years, and to me, there's just like you can't manufacture meaning, you can't manufacture importance of the other game and try to make the game important. Why do you, as baseball, why does the All-Star Game have to be important? You know, if guy, you know, you want to have guys leave early after the, I mean. First of all, guys are not going to leave early if you don't take them out the game. So if you want to keep guys in the dugout, just don't take them out the game. Let the stars play, you know, 6 or 7 innings. You want to change pitchers, then fine, change pitchers. But let the position players play 6 or 7 innings. The All-Star Game has turned into a circus. You have a million players. You have a million players on the rosters. You're putting pressure on these managers to treat it like it's game 7. With every move being dissected, well, why wasn't A-Rod put in for David Ortiz? And Driver, you know, why wasn't this pitcher taken? Why wasn't this player put in for this player? It's an all-star game. I mean, who gives a damn about an all-star game? You know, take the importance out. And the idea that home field advantage is determined by the winner of the all-star game is the biggest joke in sports right now. No other league does that. None of the league will come close to doing that. I mean, if football has a Pro Bowl, they do their thing, and it's like, okay, you know, we're gonna play this game and get it over with, and let the season end, and let the season end right there. You know, basketball with the All-Star game, I mean, just go towards a traditional way of giving out home court and home field advantage through whichever team enters the World Series with the best record. I mean, to me, it works in the NBA, it works in hockey. I don't see why it would not work in Major League Baseball. I don't know why baseball has for years always tried to separate themselves in terms of how they deal with home field advantage in the World Series. I don't understand it. First, it was you know they alternated. There were alternated years where American League would get it, National League get it, which to me made zero sense. This makes even less sense. Trying to actually put meaning into this game. Sure, there was a time where the All-Star Game was an event and was the biggest. You know, was prestigious and it was in its own right. But, you know, but the days of Pete Rose and Ray Fosse are long gone. It's 2010. People are summertime on vacation. People are not, don't watch too much TV during summertime. People are, are out and about doing whatever. I mean, nobody cares about a baseball All-Star game. It's not a big deal outside the realm of sports to the casual sports fan. So I don't know why baseball makes a mistake of trying to create meaning for this All-Star, for the All-Star game. I just don't understand it. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll wrap up. A couple of things that are going on in sports, that occurred over the course of this week, as far as NFL, some NFL news. We'll talk about that and much, much more as we wrap up this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Minutes after the 11 o'clock hour. Of course, I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you to the top of the 12 o'clock hour. Sam Bradford is in negotiations for a contract deal with St. Louis that reportedly is going to pay him anywhere from $45 to $50 million in guaranteed money. This is a guy who hasn't thrown one NFL pass, a guy who comes in to the NFL with injury question marks in regards to his shoulder. And, it's amazing. Again, this is a problem with the NFL, and this is a problem with the owners complaining about what the players make and complaining about the whole sharing, the revenue sharing. When you give out contracts of this magnitude, can you, and it's just like the NBA with the owners giving guys like Amir Johnson $34 million, giving Darko Milicic $20 million. I mean, how can they really complain about revenue and about losing money when they're giving out these enormous and ridiculous amounts of money? I mean, Sam Bradford has not thrown an NFL pass. He's going to get a $50 million signing bonus, which would be the highest in NFL history. He's going to get a higher signing bonus than Peyton Manning, than Tom Brady, than any major quarterback, Drew Brees, and he hasn't thrown a pass. $50 million signing bonus. What would happen if the owners of the Rams say, hey, Sam, we'll give you $35 million or we'll give you $40 million. What could he do? Is he going to hold out and make no money? Is he going to re-enter the draft and try to risk not being the number one pick? Because he would not be the number one pick if he re-entered the draft in 2011. Okay. I mean, he has, these players have no bargaining power whatsoever coming into the NFL. They don't. So why these teams and owners continue to give them these ridiculous rookie signing bonuses is beyond me. I don't want to hear about any NFL owners complaining about money. I really don't. None of the players' contracts are guaranteed except the bonus money. So we'll see what happens with that that ordeal. Of course, Johnny Jolly suspended for the Packers for 2010. It looked like he's going to do some jail time. Jail time for violating the substance abuse policy with that. So, you know, just bad news for the Packers. I will see you in a couple of weeks. So long, and have a great week.